So, good morning, everybody. My name is Stefan Boy. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Computer Science. It's my great pleasure today to introduce Oliver Deussen for this collective behavior colloquium. Oliver Deussen is the wizard of the pixels. He's doing science in rendering, graphics, virtual reality, and all other kinds of related subjects. And I think he's going to tell us a lot more about that in his presentation on non-photorealistic rendering, how to display and abstract objects for humans. Mm-hmm. Please.
Thanks. Yeah, so thanks for the introduction. You might wonder why, how this is related to collective behavior. First of all, I'm one of the computer science guys who try to really build up these infrastructures for virtual realities, for experiments for animals. But secondly, what I want to speak about is quite why do we abstract information and how do we do that? I think is a question that is not just interesting for humans. Yeah, so for example, to me, it seems to be an open question to what extent is that possible for animals? Are animals at all able to understand in some sense abstracted information? And then what does that mean? What kind of abstractions work for them? I think that's an interesting question because we always have the feeling that this kind of abstract views are something that is completely only possible for humans, but are we sure? Yeah. So I think there are a number of questions that could come or could be interesting also for these kind of virtual realities in the cluster. And this is why I'm brave enough to confront you with that more computer science related stuff today. I hope it's interesting for everybody, and I hope that I'm able to transfer why we are doing that and why it's an interesting research topic for us. Yeah. So, as Stefan already mentioned, computer graphics creates these photos that look like photography. So in many areas we are able to fool the human eye. Yeah, you know that from movies. I concentrated in the last years on creating these virtual environments, and today, they are almost indistinguishable from reality. And but not just that, also for human kind of human looking like figures, that's possible. And even in rendering different materials, our field is getting better and better. So what we see here is like it's very hard to render something like milk because it's an emulsion. It's a combination of liquid and lipids, and so you have to do quite some math that your glass of milk does not look like paint as it does on the right side. Yeah. So what my colleagues did here is to really introduce subsurface scattering. So that means they simulate how light goes into the material, is bounced around, is scattered in various ways, and then it goes out. That's what you see in the middle. And in addition, you also have to change the frequencies of the light to get this feeling of milk, what we see here on the left side, where it's getting a little bit yellowish and bluish. And all these effects need a quite deep understanding of physics that allow people then to do these kind of renderings. And the nice thing is that now also some fields in physics benefit from our methods because my colleagues develop very fast, very efficient methods to do this light transport simulation in various ways that now can be used also for other applications like in heat transfer and all kinds of physical simulations. Yeah, so that is really possible today, and in many parts of computer graphics, you could say that's now industry standard. However, traditional computer graphics is just one little piece of the space of images at all. And as we know, of course, from arts, there are many different ways of how we can represent visual information, and that depends also, of course, heavily on the application. Yeah, for example, if we speak about illustration, that's a typical medical illustration that contains of some abstracted information and some text. And by the way, also the abstracted information is heavily changed in its scale because the inner ear is very, very small in comparison to the outer. So typically it's scaled up by a factor of, I don't know, dozens, so that we can see something at all. Yeah, so All these images here are computer generated, and they are just some examples of other non-photorealistic images that also can be generated by the computer. And the question is, by what kind of mathematical principles is that possible? Yeah, so there are some reasons for doing that, not just from the applications, but also I would say it's optimality. Artists in some ways learned to represent visual information for us in a way that is optimal in that sense, that with a minimum amount of strokes they're able to trigger our perception in a way that we immediately understand what they mean. Yeah, and that's really nice, because yeah, as we see here, these animals, I mean, they don't have to do much with the real silhouette. I mean, of course, a little bit, yeah, just enough, yeah, but the trick is that Picasso and other artists are able to fool our perception, not just the perception of an individual human, but just of us humans. Yeah, almost everybody is able to see these kind of animals in these brush strokes, and that's quite interesting, because it's yet not completely clear how, why is this the case. Yeah, so do we have an instance in our brain that is able to see, or that converts the photorealistic things that we see to some kind of line representation, then is directly triggered by that kind of drawings. Yeah, so that's not really clear. It's also optimal in that sense that if I want to show something very complex like this landscape on the right hand side, yeah, of course I can create billions of triangles like I did in these images here. Here in this image we have, I guess, 2 billion triangles that we generated and rendered. So that's an average of hundreds of triangles per pixel. Yeah, that's a big waste of geometry, of computing power, and so on. And if I want to just show a scene, I might just generate some lines, yeah, and get the same effect with much less bandwidth. Yeah, so also from the technical point of view, abstractions, depending on the application, might be able to save us a lot of computing power and bandwidth. However, there's also a second reason why I'm interested in that, because abstraction conveys a different kind of information. With abstract renderings, we can transport a different message. And there's a very influential book I can recommend to everybody who's interested in that, Scott McCloud, Understanding Comics. It's a book about understanding comics, written in the form of a comics, but it's in fact perceptual psychology. It's a great book. And he had this figure in his book where he just shows a photograph of a person, and then he abstracts this photograph. Yeah, so he abstracted a little bit more and even more. And of course, now the question is, how can you abstract this kind of representation of the face? Yeah, maybe like this. Yeah, that's maybe the most abstract version of a face. However, his message from the book is there's even a more abstract representation of that. Now you could wonder, what could that be? Yeah, but this is about comics, and he says even more abstract than that is the word face. Yeah? So the point is, while we have this access from being realistic to abstract, we also have an exit from something specific, a person on the left side and a concept on the right side. Yeah, and like a word is very clearly a concept for something. It's not, yeah, face as a word is maybe the most general concept for, yeah, what we think a face is. And If we represent things more realistically, it's like things, we represent things. And if we represent objects in a more abstract representation, we represent concepts. And for example, we had a landscape planning project where we created virtual landscapes for companies that then used that for planning processes. And at a certain point, these guys told us, well, we are not so much interested at all in these photorealistic images, because we might end up in problems with our customers. For example, the customer might come after 10 years and tells me, oh, look, my garden looks completely different than what you showed to me, yeah, when you sold me the garden or the park. Yeah. And that's a problem of the photorealistic image, because the photorealistic image, since it transports the message of being a thing, also a prediction, looks like this will be looking like that in 10 years, yeah, what you are not able to really know when you do landscape planning. Yeah. So it would be much better to abstract the images a little bit. Yeah. This is what we then did, and this was the starting point of my works on computer-generated abstractions also of these landscapes. I will show them in a couple of minutes. Yeah. But there, that was the first time to me when I understood that these landscape planners draw these lines, not because they cannot draw photorealistic, but because they want to draw it in an abstract way to convey the message, this is a plan. That's a prediction. That's not reality. Yeah. So while computer graphics creates these photorealistic images for all kinds of applications in movies or games where you want to fool somebody and it should look like reality, there's a big group of applications where people by purpose want to have non-photorealistic renditions for exactly these reasons. Yeah, give me some examples. They are in part not from my group, just to show you what has been done. For example, people worked a lot in trying to imitate traditional media, like creating images that look like painted. There are even people that very carefully simulate the interaction of paint and paper, and real oil paint is not just something 2D but 3D, so you need to really model the 3D shape of the paint, do these glossy reflections to get this idea of something was painted by a brush and real paint. Yeah, here we see result where they also carefully abstracted the background more than the foreground. Yeah. So like the face of the woman looks almost like photorealistic, while the background, you see the strokes quite clearly. I told you there are also some mathematical details that are interesting about abstraction. For example, if you just try to create silhouette lines, then from a mathematical point of view, the silhouette lines are parts of the geometry. Let's think you have an underlying 3D geometry of a head. Then the silhouette lines are those parts of the geometry where the surface normal vector, like every surface element has a normal vector pointing, yeah, perpendicular to it. And wherever these normal vectors are in the image plane, that's where we have a silhouette line. That's clearly the case for all the parts of the geometry where the geometry is separated from the background, but also for those parts here, like in the nose or for the eye. But if you do so and compute that, you see you don't have enough lines. So people came up with the concept of suggestive contours, and that's what we see here on the right-hand side. And this is the silhouette lines and contours plus those parts of the contours that would be contours if you would change your eyes just a little bit, some degrees. Yeah, so this is how the right image was created. And yeah, there is a little bit of a mathematics behind it, to what kind of degree and in what kind of direction do you have to move your eyes. But it's relatively simple, and the output of that almost looks like as a human painter would have tried to sketch this face. Yeah, so what painters and people do when they draw paintings, drawings, they also use mathematical principles, often just without knowing it. Yeah, because of course it's not taught like that, yeah, and it doesn't make sense for them to know what they do. But in fact, we see in many cases that some relatively simple mathematical methods are behind these kind of creations. Or we take a look at that here. That's somebody tried to do hatching lines, yeah, to indicate this darker parts of the objects. And what you do is, first of all, you create some silhouette lines, and then on the objects you try to get the main directions, and that is defined by the curvature of the object. Yeah, in every point on the geometry you have like a maximum curvature and a minimum curvature, and by using these directions and connecting them, you can create this kind of direction field, and then you just render the lines in the way that the darker lines represent the darker parts of the object, and here where we have the highlights, you just don't draw the lines. Yeah? So it's a modulation according to the the lightness of the object, but the direction of the lines are just given by the geometry of the underlying object. And that seems to be another relatively simple mathematical description of how people draw lines. Interesting now is that they did some perceptual studies to find out what is the optimal representation of lines to show an object. So they took some objects and abstracted them, and there are, as I said, some different methods. And then they tried to compare where do people best obtain the shape of objects from these lines. But it turned out that our eye is very tolerant. It seems to be enough to have a consistent form of representation in a mathematical sense and a representation that has a little bit with representing the lighter and darker parts of an object. And aside from that, there is no clear answer to the question which of these line definitions is the best to represent objects, since, as I said, we are quite tolerant in using different representations. Yeah, so there's quite some space still left to explore and to find out if we get better answers to that. And by the way, here we are only speaking of still images. I didn't speak so far on animated images or virtual reality. That's also a very interesting field, how to do these abstracted representations for virtual reality, where you have much different ways of perspectives and how you show images, and you need to do even other ways of abstraction there. As I said, I worked a little bit on abstracting these natural objects. Here's the big problem: you don't have geometry, you cannot easily determine, I mean, not traditional geometry. For example, it's very hard to determine for a tree with millions of leaves what is the normal and make it useful. So we tried to come up with some descriptions of to create from an object such a representation or such a much more abstracted representation by using, for example, what we call depth differences. That means, like, if you, for example, if you draw a mountains, yeah, then you draw the different peaks of the mountains only if they are far enough behind the next mountains. Yeah, so that's one way of how artists remove the details. And we took a very similar concept of distances in depth that indicates how much of the geometry you really show. And then in combination with the abstraction of the form, you get to images like that that also look a little bit like how humans would do this kind of abstractions. But then we extended that and came up with all kinds of different ways to abstract objects, and even created a system where the user has some sliders where he can introduce or remove special ways of abstracting things, from hatchings, from different shapes up to whatever, some kind of Van Gogh-like representation, and so on. So we just explored that space and tried to find out what are the ways of how we can represent the objects. We worked on watercolor, because here, in addition, you have these transparencies, and the question is, how do you, in the right way, add transparency to your color? And also had different versions of the same objects. And that's the nice thing, when you have these methods, you can always animate them. Yeah. But here, the problem again is, if you have like such a complex object, and that's not just the case for trees, but also for other objects, you have like a lot of occlusions and disocclusions if you rotate it. Yeah. All the time, something comes to the front and goes back to the back. And so you have to work on making things coherent. You don't want this flickering, yeah, if leaves appear and go back. So the concept that we used here, and you can see that a little bit in this tree while it rotates, is instead of having an immediate occlusion and disocclusion in the animation, we use transparency to do occlusions and disocclusions. So if objects come close, they get transparent, both of them, and then they switch the orientations, and then they get less transparent again. That was a nice idea that worked very well for these watercolor objects. And now it seems like it's one important idea to also optimize plants, because currently we are working on things like using neural networks to optimize plants for all kinds of purposes. And here you also need, because you optimize, you need images that are smooth in all the time, because you want to compute derivations and you need derivations for your optimization. Yeah, so you cannot have these occlusions and disocclusions, and it seems like this kind of using transparency for that to create a very smooth renditions is a very good way to go in that direction. I will show some neural network kind of non-photorealistic renderings in a couple of seconds. But let me first again say some more words on applications. Of course, comics are a big application for that. Now you would maybe see, oh, comics, that's not a big deal. But it's unbelievable how many comics are created every day on the planet. Yeah, go to Japan, yeah, it's like hundreds of comics per day are created. It's a big industry there, not just in Japan. And more of this industry is generated also automatically. So they draw by hand, but they add a lot of content now based on computer-generated things, because it's just much, much less work. Then, of course, animation movies and games. There's a tendency now for computer games also to have a specific look. They don't try to be just realistic anymore. They also try to have like their specific look to really keep people playing their game. So that's also an application for these techniques. And of course, in movies, I guess everybody knows that we have a lot of animated movies now. But another very important application is automatic illustration. If you have complex objects like an engine, think about an airplane, yeah, the amount of illustrations that you need to produce is like hundreds of thousands. And they have these big databases, how they store the geometry. And the big question is, can you automatically generate illustrations for certain purposes? Like, for example, automatically doing explosion drawings, which is geometrically also not completely trivial. So like there's a lot of work on trying to do these kinds of things, because they just want to avoid employ people to draw that manually, and they want to avoid to do that all the time again if they change the specification. That's the big problem. Yeah, you have like an airplane all the time is changed, you have different engines, it develops over time. You don't want to manually keep track of all these updates, but you want to do that automatically. So that's another big and more serious application of these techniques. Or you want to create a special kind of renditions for CAD systems. That's a project that we did. It's a company that sells ovens and bathrooms to customers. And the big problem was that the customers, they don't want to see a technical drawing. So this company employed painters that painted their technical outputs with some colors to make them a little bit more beautiful. But it was restricted and also not possible to animate them. So we developed like a little system for them that now creates these kind of outputs that are a little bit more romantic. Because, I mean, if you want to have a customer pay, I don't know, 30,000 euros for a bathroom, it should have a romantic or whatever kind of flavor. And we try to render it. Okay, now I want to give you a little insight about a project that we just did in the last year. And here the question was, okay, we are now able to abstract objects, but are we able to give users a system where the user can have a dial and say, like, I want to have 30% abstraction. Now make me the representation. Is that possible at all? Yeah, can we quantify the degree of abstraction? And that's a complicated question, because perception is involved and our perceptual system is not linear. Yeah, so how can we translate this question of the visual degree of abstraction to the technical parameters of our system? So what we did is we took an abstraction method that is very simple, that is called stippling. You might know it from biology. You use little dots to represent texture and grayscale of whatever animals, or in archaeology, it's quite popular. And long time ago, I developed a method to mimic that kind of point distribution in a mathematical way. I just tell you briefly how that works. We did an update last year to do that dynamically. Let's think about we have that would be our painting we want to represent with these dots. Then it's clear every of these dots represent a certain amount of ink. Yeah? So if you distribute them, you can say the dot is responsible for the area around itself. And that's something that you know, for example, from animals, the so-called Voronoi diagram. Yeah, every animal has like a certain area that it tries to defend. Yeah, and then if there are these nice images of fish on the ground of the sea, where these local territories are the Voronoi cells around the fish. Yeah, it's just the same principle. So each of these dots would have represent an area, and so we have now three mechanisms. Within the iteration, each of these dots try to move to the center of its own area. And then we have these red Voronoi cells, and that's the cells where the size of the dot does not have enough ink to represent the grayscale value of this area. And in this case, we split the cell. And there are these grayish parts on the left, where it's just the other way around, too many dots. Then we remove some of them. Yeah, so it's like that's what we do in the iteration, remove some dots and split some others. And if we continue this iteration very, very fast, we get a stable kind of a point distribution. And this then allows you to create things like that. Representing archaeological stuff, you can vary the amount of dots in the same image. You can create different dot sizes with respect to the image information, like for example the image gradient, or you can use it for artistic purposes to just put the attention of the viewer to a certain part of such a rendition. Okay, so that's the technique. It's relatively simple. Here, the technical parameters for this most simple experiment is just the number of dots. So now, can we find out what is the best abstract representation of a given input model, or can we maybe find out from the user what would be a 30% abstraction? Yeah? So that was our question. So we used that algorithm to represent the object, but as I said, the same object can be represented with too few dots, or maybe
with too many dots. I mean, of course, in the extreme
case, if every dot gets very small, it ends up to be a pixel. Yeah, you just you have a grayscale image. That doesn't make sense. So there's something in between, maybe 50% of whatever, that might be optimal. Yeah, and there's like a number of trade-offs. It's just with this, you don't want it to be too photorealistic. It should also be not too abstract because you lose the details. And also, there might also be like a question of the computation time that is needed. Yeah. So what is a good trade-off for the viewer? So our experiment was done as follows. First of all, we needed to do a normalization because, as I said, for a dark object, you need more dots than for a light object. So you need to normalize it to a grayscale level. Then we did like a number of comparison tests. That were like used in a user study, and then we at the end try to evaluate them. And the big thing here is that the problem is, that's first on normalization, but the big problem that we have is users typically are not able to judge absolutely. Our eyes are not built for that, so it's absolute judgment. So it had to be a relative comparison. Yeah, and as I said, the first thing was to normalize it. That means like we have like we know that we need more points for the left image than for the right because it's darker. So we defined something that we called the tonal percentage. It's the a tonal percentage of 100% would mean to represent the object in a photorealistic way, and that's then the amount of pixels that we would need for to represent the ink. Yeah. So, for one object, 5% of the tonal percentage would be an abstract representation, and 25% a less abstract representation. And for different objects, the same tonal percentage would mean different amounts of points. Yeah, so that's our normalization, how we judged that. Okay. Now, as I said, the problem is that we cannot do absolute studies. Because that's our eyes are not built for that, so we had to do something that is a relative study. Yeah. Nobody knows what is good, how can we judge that. It's also very hard what would be minimum and maximum scores. I said, maximum, the 100% is just a photorealistic image. That's trivial. Yeah. So we decided to do a relative comparison where we showed the realistic image in the middle and then two abstractions on both sides and ask the user their preferences. So we did like a 5-point Likert scale and try to find out, is this a more appropriate way to represent the object, or is the other one a more appropriate way to represent the object? And we just said it's better or worse, but we've used these 5 points so the users could also distinguish between much better and just a little bit better. We did that with 6 input images from these typical domains. And we computed 20 discrete tonal representatives for that, that were distributed logarithmically because the more points you have, the harder it is to distinguish differences. Yeah? So there was like from the beginning, our estimation was that it will be something like a logarithmic kind of relation between them. So in that we let people do. So we found out we need like an order of 63,000 valid answers. And so you take your 10 students from the lab. Now, that's not possible to do in a lab study, so we did a crowdsourcing study, and we learned a lot about that. But before I come to that, just let me explain how we get to absolute values from that. Yeah, because we have these relative data. Users just tell us I like that more than that, or much more than that. And how do I get an absolute scale from that? Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like a little bit like you let people vote on the quality of clubs, and by having enough votes, you can just do vote counting. But there's a little bit better method for that. It's these Thurston's models that are known since almost 100 years. It's like you give also some weight to the votes, and as I already said, we don't just have binary votes, but this kind of 5-point Likert scale. So what you get here is you do a lot of comparisons because between all these different representations, and then you count votes, and here in these matrices we see the difference in the color. You see how many people voted for, like, of course, if the tonal percentage of the same of the left and the right image is the same, then the result should be no difference. And most people do that. They do it more likely for small amounts of points. And you see here for higher amounts of points, people are not able to see it's really the same. Yeah. And here we have these matrices for a vote of slightly better or much better. Yeah, and by computing maximum likelihood estimation, you then can come to these more absolute scores. So what we see here is for the 6 different objects that are these 6 measures, we show the reconstructed mean abstraction scores. These from our model over the tonal percentages, or we see it here. Since these here the tonal percentages are in a linear scale, you can also show it in a more logarithmic scale, and then we see that there is like a good relation between how people judge these relative values and the amount of tonal percentage that is that was taken to represent these objects. Yeah, and if we fit curves to that, and here we just fit a logarithmic curve to that, we see that it even does not depend too much on the objects. That was also a question that we had. We thought like maybe for a human skull or something with many details, you need much more points for the same kind of perceived degree of abstraction, but it does not seem to be the case, which we found interesting and needs more investigation. Also something I should say, that this fitting of the curve, yeah, logarithmic curve, makes sense, but maybe there might be another curve that even fits better. But interestingly, as I said, we now can define something like there's like a value where the perceived degree of abstraction does not go up anymore. And of course, there's also like a minimum where you typically don't see much details anymore. And in between, we now have a nice relation between how much of these tonal percentages do we need, also how much points do we need, and how is the degree of abstraction that is perceived by the users. And for us, that's at least an interesting indication of that something like that really exists. And we are currently working on studies where we now vary the point sizes. We even start to use, instead of points, little hatching lines here. We have an additional problem that these hatching lines are better for representing some objects than for others. Yeah, you have like a preferred direction that might be better for representing straight lines than round objects. We even saw a little bit of a higher variance depending on the objects, but this is just work that is just in progress. But overall, we get like similar curves here. It's even like this fitting of a logarithmic curve, I think, is not the best fit. But the tendency is like that. Okay, so that's what we currently do. We have this Sonderforschungsbereich about quantitative methods for visual computing, and that's one of these objects where we try to quantify visual effects. We try to quantify the whole pipeline from data generation up to perception and find out how are we able to generate images and visualizations where we can predict how the user will see them. That's the idea, yeah? Involving also the human perception process. And something similar would also be interesting for the cluster, of course. Since that's one of the topics of the cluster, as you all know, animals react to video. Please forgive me that I just took something from YouTube, but it's so obvious that animals clearly react to video footage. It's known from cats and a lot of birds and so on react to that. We already have this fish VR, you know Ian's experiments about this matrix with these little fish tanks, and currently we're setting up something for locusts also. So we now try to build VR systems at least for single animals where we try to fool them. And but it's for many species not yet clear, are we able to fool them? Yeah, you remember this talk of the bee researcher from Berlin, Landgraf, that try to feed bees with video so that they find their way in the real world, and it turned out not to be possible, at least not with the setting that he used. So later he took some drones and attached the bees to the drones and used that to fly them around. But the interesting question is why? Do bees need much more information than just the visual information? Is the bee eye, the insect eye, which is totally different from the human eye, can we even feed it with projectors? Yeah, it's known that insects have very high refresh rates or frequencies for their eyes, like 200 hertz, 300 hertz. So you clearly cannot use normal projectors that work with 100 hertz. It's very painful for these insects, I guess. Yeah. So we need special projectors. We already bought one that has 1,200 hertz. And so what else does, I mean, is even the form of the pixels that we use, how does it fit to the the arrangement of these insects' eyes. Yeah, we don't know because they are so different from our human eyes, and everything we developed is of course optimized for our human eye. Yeah, so that's really interesting also for me. Yeah, because we don't just have to render stuff photorealistically for us, but for the animals. And what does that mean? And as a second question, if you abstract information for the animals, is that, can we find if some animals are even able to recognize an abstracted version of one of their colleagues? Yeah. So one of the things we are currently thinking about is creating a virtual mirror. Yeah, there are these mirror experiments where Alex gave a fascinating talk some weeks ago, and we thought, like, let's generate a fish, and first try to generate the fish in a way that it really looks like a mirror. That would involve also having a very good tracking, because you have to be very fast to generate the information. And once we would have that, we could also try to slightly abstract it. Abstract it in the form of how it moves, how it looks, and so on, and gradually move away from the most photorealistic representation we are able to do. And that would, of course, be quite interesting to see how different species would react to that. So that's like a little bit my overall plan for the next time from my point of view. As a computer scientist, yeah, we are mostly at that corner of the cluster. And but it's not just serving you, biology people. I think it's also very interesting for my own field, because we will learn much more about abstraction beyond what we already do. Now, I said last part of my talk, I want to tell you a bit about my fancy painting robot. That's something that I do since a couple of years. We started by creating these abstract representations, but this was always pixel images. And at a certain point, I thought it would be so nice, instead of creating pixel images, to draw with a real paint on a real canvas. And so we took an industry robot and converted the industry robot into a painting machine.
We present a painting machine and associated algorithms able to paint.
Yeah, as we see here. So that's the version. And our nice shop people helped us to equip the robot with, like, so that it now can grasp different brushes. We have a paint repository where the machine takes its paint from. But the very important aspect of the machine is that it supervises itself. So we have a camera, we see here, that takes a picture. And so all the time when the robot painted some strokes, we obtain a picture of the canvas and compare the picture with the input image. And this way we create new strokes. Like real painters, we don't judge the image as one piece. We divide it into different parts and paint from back to front, like so that we have like big strokes in the background and then smaller strokes in the foreground. And you see the effect here. And here we see of how such a painting is created. So it's like many, many of these feedback iterations with paint that is relatively translucent. And over time with these mechanisms, you get something, you will see a better result in a second by the machine. And the good thing is, using this feedback loop enables us to create much better paint representations than any other machine was able to do before. Here we see the principle. If this is the input object, very simple is we compute what is the difference between what is on the canvas and what is in the input. At the beginning, the canvas is white, so the difference we see here, and then over time, strokes are added until the difference is getting minimal. Yeah, so this is the general process. So we have this comparison of canvas and input, and we have an optimization method that creates the strokes. Yeah, and we have different algorithms for that to create different styles. Yeah, so this is a very mechanistic way to draw, but now you can add all kinds of more semantics on top of it. Yeah, for example, that's an output image. Later, we then worked with oil paints or acrylic paint, which is easier to handle with. And as I said, yeah, it's quite nice how the machine creates some textures and as I said, these kind of subtle things you only get by this feedback mechanism, a very thin paint, otherwise the machine would create much less nice results. Yeah, here we see this image that we saw from the video in a better way. So that's interesting. We also have some collaborations with artists. You might have seen in the BIP, we had a little exhibition last month where Liat did something, and that's quite interesting. And our current works are about a question that people ask us over and over again, and that we don't have a clear answer to now, and that's can't we use artificial intelligence to draw our images? Yeah, like to what extent can computers do these decisions of how to represent an object do by their own? And there are already quite interesting works. You might have seen them. For example, people took neural networks to transfer the style from one painting to a photograph. So like there are networks that take this photo and this whatever Turner artwork and then transfer the color of this artwork in a reasonable way to the photo on the left side. And that's quite interesting. Yeah, so that this is these networks can be trained to understand somehow the overall structure of the input photo so that they don't just transfer the paint or the colors from here randomly to these houses, but in a way that looks quite artistically. And that's of course very interesting. And there are other networks that are even, I think, more interesting GANs. These networks are not just a neural network, but it's like it has several instances. It's a network and then it that generates something. And then there's an instance in this machine that is a discriminator that tries to distinguish what the network created from real input. So for example, you try to let the network draw portraits, and you give it as an input many, many oil paintings of portraits, and then the network starts to generate something. And then the discriminator in this GAN tries to distinguish between what the network created and what is a real oil portrait given from an extended set of input images. And then over time, and that's the interesting thing, not just the generator is optimized, but also the discriminator is optimized. It tries to be better and better and distinct so that there are two opposite processes in this GAN that work against each other and by this way jointly optimize them. So the discriminator gets better and better to distinguish real from fake images, and the fake image generator gets better to produce these images. Very interesting. And if you feed them with portraits, then after some time these GANs create that. And yeah, of course we see these are not real portraits. Yeah, it's like things are missing. They look strange. But on the other hand, they look a little bit portrait-ish. Yeah, yeah. If you just on the first sight, yeah, you think it's like a little bit like a portrait. So it seems like this network learned like it's always like a background and there's something round before, and it has some kind of thing in it, yeah? So gradually the network without, yeah? The network doesn't know anything about images, anything about portraits, anything about eyes, knows something. It just learns from this input data by this joint optimization of generator and discriminator what would be the essence of a portrait. Yeah, and that's so interesting because this kind of unsupervised training, or nearly unsupervised training, it's supervised in the sense that it always only gets portraits and not other stuff, yeah, is very interesting in this question of how does cognition work and what is needed to understand things, yeah. And so also these GANs are very interesting. Only our problem is we don't work with images and textures, but at the end with strokes. Our machine needs strokes. So we cannot directly apply this kind of CNNs to our things. We need to use other methods to learn, because at the end what we want to learn is like paths for the robot to draw our portraits. But that's also interesting, but it seems like reinforcement learning or other kind of artificial intelligent techniques are much better for us than using CNNs. Yeah, and so I gave you hopefully an interesting overview about my research. Yeah, the future is like that. Even dogs enjoy virtual reality. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
For the VR with the animals, futuristic ideas, you said that you might want to go from photorealistic to more basic abstract. But if you see the research which is in the VR stuff, it's rather going in the other direction.
Yeah, it's true.
From very abstract, basic, because so. Why do you prefer one way over the other?
No, I would say like for the fish, we started with, like, I guess there were different attempts, and then it turns out that some parts of this virtual fish have to be shown precisely, and then the rest is not so important because the other fish is only has a very simple way to judge is that a fish or not. So for me, the degree of abstraction is this kind of questions. What do we have to show so that animals understand what it is and how to understand also how that does their visual system function? And you're right, we would go from trying to do something very, very realistic and then abstract it down. But of course, you could also try to start from something very abstract and then gradually add stuff until you see reactions in the right way. So the direction, I think, is not so much important. It's just like a way of how do you approach things. Yeah. But because if you start from something very abstract, it's not clear what is it, because you have so different ways to start with an abstract representation. Yeah, could start from only showing the outline or some specific textural features. Yeah. That's very much intuition. If you have like a very realistic representation, then you can gradually abstract it in different ways and find out what happens. Yeah.
Yeah, because so just the normal debate is that how do we know that it's realistic for the animal? So it's by definition the realistic appearance that we try to create.
Yeah. Yeah.
Will still be not realistic based on just different visual properties. So it's already maybe in some form bit abstract too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, it depends on what kind of abstraction, what degree is needed. I think it's very specifically also for the different systems. Yeah.
Now my question is from a computational point of view. Is it cheaper to have anything done the same way with very high definition, so it's perfect for the foveare, and the rest is just an add-on that's cheap because it's the same? Or would it be cheaper to calculate the high definition, the high speed at the center, and then ignore the rest and find out how to simplify the periphery?
Yeah. So, of course, the second would be much better, and the newest VR glasses, for example, have now eye tracking. So you have a little camera that you know where the user looks at exactly for that reason, so that you render only the parts that are in the center of attention of the user with high resolution. For the rest, what the very simple way would be just to use much less spatial resolution, because our eyes, the decrease is so drastic. Offside the central axis, you can render these images with a much less resolution. Or you can avoid having computationally costly optical effects there. Yeah, so that is done, and we already did a study with the Powerwall of Daniel Keim, where like it's the same thing. You have a person in front of the Powerwall. You only need a tiny fraction of the Powerwall needs to be rendered in high resolution. So we combined a tracking system for the head with an eye tracking system. It was quite challenging, but at the end, the effect was so funny because you, as a viewer, you watched the Powerwall, and it was perfectly sharp everywhere, and everybody except you saw that like 90% of the Powerwall was just showing nothing or very washy stuff. Yeah. But that's already what is done. But you're right, yeah? At the end, it makes a lot of sense.
You have to calculate where you are. Yeah. It's still cheaper to...
Yeah. See, depends on the content, of course. Sometimes it's really cheaper. But again, for animals, we don't... Or I at least don't know, yeah? For birds, I learned they have two foveas, yeah? Like one on the side and one to the front. And for For insects, I guess we don't even know. Yeah. Yeah, so this function would be much more complicated then. But yeah, interesting. Yeah.
I have this abstraction with information loss, right? In some sense, are there any information theoretic metrics that you can use in order to assess well how much abstraction there is? Also maybe with respect to the question, how much abstractions can animals tolerate?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you have any feeling for quantifying?
I just read some studies and that said that the amount of information that is at the end used by the brain, visual information, is like a ridiculously small amount of the pixel information that our eyes get. It's like in the order of, I don't know, several dozen bits per second, yeah, which is nothing. Yeah. So it means like there is a huge compression already on the eye and then in the brain. But I don't know if there are like information theoretic results that really quantify that, yeah? Yeah. But of course, yeah, it would be very helpful if we could really simulate the brain in that sense, yeah? That would be very helpful, yeah. Yeah.
So most of the examples you showed is abstractions from 2D images. I was wondering for VR, you would need something abstractions.
Of course. Of course, yeah. You can use depth, yeah, definitely.
So do you know, because I think this is more challenging to find out because the object you can rotate around and stuff.
Yeah.
In order to abstract it, I mean, using most of the methods that I saw, I think it would be difficult. For example, with the silhouettes, I mean, either you would have to make it on real time or the 2D image to get the rendered image, or you have to do it once before. But do you have any idea about how this could be?
So like using depth for modulating the abstraction, that's something we already did in some projects, and it's definitely very helpful. Yeah, it also helps you to get rid of unnecessary details. Yeah, like level of detail is always very much dependent on the depth. I think computationally we have to see. I guess it's possible today to do very complicated silhouette computations even in real time. That's not so much the but again, like, what do we need from the image to understand? Like, think about a complex virtual environment. What kind of silhouettes do you really need for understanding it? That's a different question. Yeah. But you're completely right that incorporating 3D is very important also for the abstraction. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, artists also do it the same. Yeah. The background, as I showed, is always much more. Or often much more broad than the foreground. Yeah.